Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
In this very special episode of the Bravery Academy, I'm joined by Dr. Victoria Thompson. And today we're going to be sharing some insights and wisdom around a really amazing time in a woman's life. However, we're going to be also looking at some of the challenges that occur as you are going through either fertility, experience, miscarriage, and those first few trimesters of pregnancy. We share our own wisdom along the way and some of the things that have helped us and many of the clients we work with navigate what can be a very uncertain time. Welcome back, Dr. Vic. I am really excited about this episode because I have a lot of knowledge and experience in it from my own lived experience. And now you have some news to share with us around what we're talking about today.
Yes, I got a baby on the way.
It's exciting.
But definitely this feels like a pertinent conversation around pregnancy and managing stress around that, because it's a stressful time.
Yeah, and mine are like 13 years and 10 years ago now, and I can still remember. And so I think as much as we can keep opening up around the challenges in it, because I felt very alone at many points along mine, because it's such a unique experience for everybody. Mm. So today we want to cover pre-pregnancy. There's a lot of anxiety and stress that comes in even looking at getting pregnant. And then around relationships and around those first two trimesters and what that means. And then we're going to come back in a future episode and look at what it looks like to head towards the birthing stage and then into motherhood and all the exciting parts and the challenges that come with that.
Yeah, we should be tracking along my pregnancy progression so I can let you know along the way. Yeah, I'll be next time we do that episode, it will be closed for me. So. Hey, let me know what to do.
Well, I mean, I'm only one experience, and that's the kind of beauty in this, I think. As women talk about it, then, and less fear around it, we can see that it's not going to be perfect. And there's so much of giving in to the uncertainty around pregnancy and around birthing and around motherhood that it really shakes your core. And it's a whole new evolution as a woman that often gets missed by people. So I think, starting back at the beginning, and we have a lot of people that listen to the podcast that have either looking at fertility journeys.
Yeah.
Are there things that you would recommend to help people deal with stress in this pre-pregnancy stage?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a stressful time, and there's huge amounts of pressure and a lot of information out there around, you know, what you should do and, you know, the right diet to be on and lowering your levels of stress. But I mean, it's an inherently stressful time because who knows, you know, every month it's uncertain what's going to come out of the end of it. Are you going to have to try again, or have you got a baby coming? I mean, it's huge. So I think lots of the literature is sort of, or at least maybe not the literature so much, but at least sort of conversation around it. It's like, don't be stressed. You know, you've got to not be stressed. And that's so hard. And actually what the literature is saying is that it's maybe sort of secondary, that stress actually is secondary to any sort of biological things that are going on with fertility. So although it's kind of put out there as something that feels like something we can control or is manageable, actually what the research is suggesting is that it's a bit of a chicken and the egg thing. Yeah. You know, are people struggling with fertility because they're stressed, or are they stressed because they're struggling with fertility?
I think that's a really good point. And I know a lot of friends that have been through that journey and have had to look at different ways to navigate that, because it's not your normal way of, when you're working in the medical world of infertility or that process of looking at pregnancies, understanding how your hormones and your nervous system are impacted by stress. And I think you're really right around that chicken and the egg. So it can be that your body's been in a state of dysregulation for a long time, and that's making it more challenging for the body to be able to fall pregnant. And that can feel like, again, it's out of your control. So if I'm already stressed, how am I going to make this better? And I think that's a really beautiful place for people to see that there are things that you can do that can help change that. One of the things that I know I went through is actually in my 20s, I think, because I was diagnosed, I guess, at the early age of 19, 20 with polycystic ovaries. And the people that don't understand what that is, it's a hormonal issue as well. But one thing that the doctor said to me at 19 was, you're probably not going to get pregnant and you're probably going to be infertile. And I was like, at that stage, so going through that medical roller coaster and being like, well, I've got to have kids young if I'm going to try and have them. And if there's going to be any chance. And ironically, you know, it's not everyone's journey, but I was pregnant very quickly. And so it's this process of understanding what your body's going through. And I had to really armor myself with information to know that what I went through in my 19s and 20s wasn't actually going to be the medical truth as you go through. So I think there's a lot of learning around yourself in that experience when it comes to, am I going to be able to get pregnant or am I not? And when is the right time? Do we freeze eggs? Do we try all the things?
Yeah. I was thinking about this topic actually. And the idea of it, do you know that phrase on TikTok that people use, it's like my Roman Empire? The gag is quite long, but essentially it's like this thing that I think about all the time, or that exists for me all the time. And the idea is that men think about the Roman Empire all the time. And what I've seen is that many women are like, oh, the idea that I'm infertile is my Roman Empire. And lots of people that I've spoken to, my friends, well, I'm probably infertile. So it's this sort of burden. And I felt the same, you know, because you don't know. It's a sort of burden that you sit with, at the beginning. You're like, gosh, please don't get pregnant. Mm-hmm. And then as you get, you know, as you progress, you think, well, is that even possible for me? You know, all these years that I've tried to prevent pregnancy, maybe it's not even on the cards. Mm-hmm. It's a huge burden for, I mean, I was talking specifically about women at this time, but what I see a lot in my private practice is women that have just hit 30 or in their, you know, early 30s, late 20s, and the sheer panic that ensues about timings and timelines, because, you know, in fairness, we do have those pressures that maybe, you know, aren't as pressing for men at that age. But the expectation often for women is that we've kind of got all our shit together by the time we're 30, and that's when we, you know, we should have children by now. We'll definitely be thinking about them. And for so many women, myself included, that wasn't the case.
And I think also around that partnership of who you are with at that time, many women haven't met the person that is going to be part of that journey for them, or that right person. And then we might meet someone that we do have children with, and they still might not be the person that we can parent together. There's so many unknowns with it. But if you come back just to that process of fertility, there's lots of expectations in society as well, even around people asking, oh, when are you going to get pregnant? Or have you started trying? And it's like, actually, it's really hard if you don't understand what somebody's already going through. If they've already been through months and months of trying to conceive, and the expectation that even if you just got married, that this is what you do, it's a big thing to be carrying. I think a lot of it's an invisible load.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think people often say to people struggling with fertility, you know, as soon as you just relax about it, stop thinking about it, it'll happen for you. And I mean, that's incredibly frustrating for people, because actually simply that's just not the case. You know, if infertility is being unable to conceive for a year, I mean, that's not a huge amount of time anyway. And that's quite a label to be given, you know, the panic that ensues from that. And then there's so much process that can come with that if you continue to pursue pregnancy. This idea of, we'll just stop thinking about it. But actually, no, there's a huge amount that I have to think about, you know, medical appointments, managing my stress, all of that.
I think that's a really good point around having that psychological support during that time, because it's not a normal thing that everybody will experience, but it's still a very challenging thing to go through. And again, it can be that hidden layer of stress that others don't know while you're still working and while you're still doing all these other things, because it's not seen as that you are pregnant at that point, which might mean that you can get different, not treated differently, but then you can manage your expectations. But there's a hormone roller coaster if you're on IVF treatments, all the things that will be challenging your nervous system and your body and your relationship. I think that's a really big one as well, is understanding that, how do people deal with that stress fertility in their relationship?
Yeah, I mean, the research is interesting in that area. You know, it's showing that the rates of anxiety and depression are so high for men and for women. I have the stats here if you're interested. I don't know them off by heart.
Tell me.
Oh, I've lost my voice. What a cliffhanger. Estimated that around 56% of women and 32% of men report symptoms of depression when they're undergoing fertility treatment, and anxiety being even higher, 75.9% for women and 60.6% for men.
Huge.
Huge figures. And that can be people that have no, you know, pre-existing experience of clinical levels of anxiety or depression. And it just shows the huge impact that it has. You know, if you think about all of the layers of fertility treatment, not just, you know, the uncertainty of whether it will happen for you, whether, you know, it will be successful, but the financial stress, the medical procedures, how invasive they are. And same-sex couples, who carries that burden? You know, who is the one who's going through the invasive medical stuff and the psychological burden if you're in a relationship where the fertility difficulties are one-sided? And that's a huge amount of self-blame and sense of failure that can come in for people. It's a massive strain on the relationship.
Yeah. So how do we deal with that? What are the ways that they can help themselves navigate that relationship strain at that time?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a complex issue. And what I guess is really important is, I'm going to say the cheesy line here, but you've got to communicate about it, right? You've got to understand how the other person copes. So often you can get in couples one partner who outwardly copes, you know, is really vocal about what's going on, seeks support, maybe is tearful or noticeably, you know, expresses their emotions. And then you might get the other partner who withdraws and becomes quite internalized about it. And so it's really useful sometimes just to sit down with your partner if you're going through that process and just say, what is this like for you? And how do you think that you'll cope? How will I know when things are tough for you? Because often we can misinterpret the other person's behavior because they just don't deal with things in the same way that we do. Other things to think about, of course, are that you do exist as a couple outside of fertility. Although, as consuming as it is, remembering and trying to celebrate the other aspects of your relationship that's just the two of you and putting time aside for that. My understanding is that it can become incredibly consuming for couples, and that becomes your entire focus. And if you think about sex, I mean, that it, the fertility struggles and even just conceiving in general, you know, without necessarily having infertility, it does change the dynamic of sex, and it can become quite
mechanical.
Yeah. It's like, well, I'm ovulating, so these are the, you know, these are the days. And if you think about that over a long period of time, it does change the dynamic of sex, especially when at the end of the month in your cycles, there's disappointment. So how do you keep sex spontaneous and fun still, whilst also taking into account that you kind of do have to be a little mechanical about it. In timing, not necessarily in technique.
Good clarity there.
For clarity.
I think it's a really good point to kind of give people the permission to still be able to play and use that time of intimacy to connect and to actually express the emotions that go through it. It's a roller coaster that needs to be able to be ridden in a way that you can take control when you need to. And I think that's around leaning into each other instead of leaning away.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, that's such a good point. You know, the urges, naturally one would anticipate some level of resentment that might crop up during these times. You know, maybe you're not really understanding how your partner's dealing with it, or you feel like they don't care, or you feel frustrated about, yeah, I don't know, when maybe they're still going out drinking and you've stopped drinking. And so resentment, of course, is also something massive to look out for. And how do you have enjoyable sex when there's such, you know, when that resentment is just bubbling there? Then it becomes really like an exchange of services rather than an intimate connection.
And I think some people experience that, and that's why it's so good to talk about, because I think if you don't actually notice there's those things happening, then resentment builds even more over time. So that even down the track, when and if you get pregnant, then there's still this layer of like, it's now on me, and then now it's about my body and going through that process, and it's actually taking that journey together and figuring it out. So I think that one of the biggest things for me, I would say, is actually making sure if you are struggling at that point together, is still going and getting the help and finding ways to cope and to pre-cope before you get to that point, so that you have the resources to help navigate that really tricky time and to be able to lean in and not move away from each other.
Absolutely. I think it's what we often say is things don't have to be dire straits for you to seek additional support. Look, taking into account that it's a financial stress for sure. It's not something that's, you know, offered alongside your treatment. But if you are in a position to do that, getting on top of it before it gets to a point where it feels unmanageable, to try and, you know, get some additional support, work out what your coping strategies are. How do you work through this as a team? Because it's what's so important. Like you said, what we don't want is to move apart. We want to move toward. And how do we cope with this as a team? Because it does take two to tango.
It does. I think there's it's almost an opportunity where you talk about the stress mindset, but able to put that into this experience and go, well, how do we actually navigate this in a different way? And that means you're going to have difficult conversations. Like, I'm struggling in this moment, or this isn't working for me. So I think it's around creating space together as well, because our lives can be so busy. You actually go, I haven't actually had time with you. So still prioritizing that person and your own well-being. So we look at strategies to help that out, and particularly around stress. It's making sure that you're doing the simple things that restore that nervous system. And it could be being in nature. It could be going and having a massage if you can afford those things. I know that can be a lot. But it can be also making sure that you sit and take some time just for you, whether it's going and writing or practicing some meditation or some yoga, things that bring your body back into a calm state.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
There is a lot of information, so you've got to figure out what is the right dose of information that's going to serve you in that time frame.
Yes, I think that's such a good point. I mean, my first trimester definitely fell into the trap of engaging in too much kind of catastrophic information regarding miscarriage in the first trimester. And I had to make quite a conscious decision to disengage from that because it can feel so overwhelming. And, you know, there is such a balance, like you said, with you want to be aware of any important changes or, you know, keeping yourself well. At the same time, you don't want to consume so much that your view of the likelihood of losing the baby becomes slightly skewed.
I think it's a really good point. I've worked with a lot of women that have gone through miscarriage and it's come up in their body in different ways in their lives. And it can be also this conversation around that it's more prevalent than we realize. And that I think as a society, we don't actually share those moments. And actually in years later, I know friends have been sitting around, you know, catching up with girlfriends and finally saying, oh, I actually had a miscarriage. And then they go, well, I had two, I had three, or I had one, or I didn't have any. And it's this piece of like, I think for the people it's kept to ourselves at that point. And there's a lot of, again, emotions that come up with that, whether it's shame or fear or anxiety, again, around what this means to me, why my body isn't able to go to that next stage. And I think that understanding that there is, again, it's another sort of phase of this journey through getting pregnant that may need to be honored, and it can then layer on top the impact that your body will have when you go into a pregnancy. And I think that's been one of the biggest ones from the woman that I've worked with really in the last few decades around how their body responds. So they might be into that first trimester. And again, there's just this fear until you get to that 13 weeks. And many of us sit with that, even if you haven't had a miscarriage. It's like, okay, I'm just going to hold through. I can't tell anybody. I can't tell anybody I'm going through this.
That's such a bizarre rule, really, isn't it? I was, you know, because, you know, thinking about that, I mean, the idea is, oh, you mustn't tell anyone in case you miscarry. And look, I think that there some, you know, it makes it potentially easy on you because you don't have to try and explain to everyone what's going on. But it also seems very isolating.
Yeah.
Considering, like you said, you know, the prevalence of it, that chances are someone in your friendship group has been through something like that, or at least in your wider network. And it's almost what people get sort of shamed for announcing too soon before the 12, 13 week. Mark.
Yeah, I agree. I know I couldn't actually keep mine a secret because I was so sick with my pregnancies. And so I was like, well, this is going to be what it's going to be. I need people to know because I'm not well. And it ended up being probably one of the better things. Still felt really challenging. So I had a condition in both my pregnancies called hyperemesis gravidarum, or gravidarum, depending on which country you're in, which is extreme morning sickness. So it's not just the 14, 15 weeks of a little bit of sickness, nausea and stuff. It was constantly vomiting and losing weight. So I had lost 10% of my body weight, and I'm not the biggest person anyway, and was still growing this little human, or humans, because it was one after the other. And I remember in that process feeling very glad people knew, because I actually couldn't hide it. It was like this whole stigma around keeping yourself that secret of being pregnant. It was like, that's out the window.
Yeah.
So whatever happens,
I'm going to need you either way.
Going to need you either way. And I think that's the key point there. And I wonder if it did change people's perspective on this around, particularly around the tend and befriend response for females, that stress response. We need other women around us to nurture us. So if we don't tell women around us that this is going on, then that can make us feel even more stressed and more isolated and impact that kind of the miscarriage experience afterwards and the grief that comes with that. Yeah. This huge grief.
Yeah. And that, you know, oh my gosh, I try and pronounce, let's call it HG.
HG, yeah.
I don't have it luckily, but my understanding of it is that it just absolutely rocks you to your core. It makes, you know, not only are you dealing with the natural anxieties that come along with pregnancy, but you're also, you know, often losing weight in and out of hospital. This idea of, oh my goodness, how am I going to sustain and maintain this pregnancy when I can't even hold water down.
Yeah. It was horrific in lots of ways. And I wasn't, first pregnancy, I wasn't in hospital as much because I lived rurally. So it was with the doctors. And overall, they were pretty amazing when I was like, I had to do the research, weirdly, to be like, this is what I know they're doing around the world because I don't see much of HG. This is what we need to be doing. Can you please help me with this? I need you to advocate for me to actually have the fluids and do these things to break that cycle. And the first pregnancy, I kind of got through it. The second one, It was such a roller coaster. Like, I really learned to have to fight for my medical rights in that, because one doctor was so amazing when I first went in there at 7 weeks. And I was like, oh God, I'm pregnant again. I remember being the anxiety that I felt. And finding out I was pregnant was also probably one of the most ridiculous stories. I didn't think that we weren't trying. And I remember going to some friends and feeling nauseous on the drive, being like, my ex-husband being like, wow, your driving's pretty bad today. I'm really feeling quite sick. Picked up a bottle of wine and a pregnancy test just in case at the at the New World. And then I put up with friends and I was just like, oh, well, you know, I don't think I am. And they're like, go to that test.
Oh, gosh.
And I came out like white as a ghost. I was like, it's actually positive. And I remember that. So it's not always these joyful experiences that people have. It wasn't the, hey, here's the big reveal.
Yeah, it's like, oh my God, I know what's coming. And this is going to be horrific. Yeah.
So I was very clearly like, we need to go to the doctor tomorrow. I need to get a plan in place. I need to be able to find my way of coping. And I was really clear that I wanted to actually make sure I spoke to somebody through that first trimester to get me through.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because I think that my experience was that I'm going to actually express it because I want to make sure that I have a way of coping, because the fear and the anxiety that I had in that experience is probably the most I've had in compared to other life experiences. Like, it was such an adversity experience going through that pregnancy, knowing that for the next, I don't know how many weeks, ended up being around 25, 28 weeks, I was still being sick.
Yeah.
And I was on pretty big dose medication.
Yeah.
And particularly having to fight with one of the doctors to be like, I need IV fluids. This is what they do around the world. I'm not driving 3 hours to Dunedin to a hospital to get this, because it'll defeat the purpose.
Yeah.
And the other doctor, the male doctor, being like, of course. The female one, like, just go away for a day. Go away for a day and see how you feel. I was like, I know how I feel.
I'm going to feel like shit.
I can't keep any food down me. I'm very, very unwell. And I think that's been the lesson around listening to my body through this through one of the biggest milestones around mind-body connection to me. And the stress that I'd been through before that point, getting pregnant, to then get to that stage where my body's like, I'm shutting you down. You are not listening and you're not coping. And I think there's so much more to it. And I look back at those pregnancies and go, they weren't the beautiful, blissful, oh, wow, I'm just popping out. It was like, I'm barely popping out because there's nothing around me to do that with. And I think for me, I've looked at so many friends and clients and people that I work with, and there's no one part of that journey that's all smooth sailing. That's the pace of pregnancy. I think you either get the rough getting pregnant, you get the rough pregnancy or the birth and the baby. And I mean that in the, like, you're never going to get the quad factor or whatever it is, like the full.
I think so, though. I think in certain cases.
You might be able to. Doesn't mean doom and gloom. If you hadn't got that so far, you'd be like, amazing.
No, I think, I mean, it's realistic, isn't it? And anyway, it's such a good point, is that actually the way that pregnancy is presented is so different to the reality of it for many people. I mean, you know, some people do have that lovely experience, but a lot of people, you spend the first 12 weeks just feeling like ass, and it's stressful, and you don't know if everything's progressing normally. You don't get that first appointment for ages. Like, you know, in most cases, you don't have a scan in most cases until 12 weeks, which is, or 12, 13 weeks, which I remember we went in for the first appointment and confirmed the pregnancy. They're like, oh, we'll see you in about, you know, a month or something, or 6 weeks. And I was like, what do you mean?
How did it feel?
That was terrifying, because I thought, oh, no, I don't know. I guess I anticipated more oversight. But there was, in my case, I'm not a high risk pregnancy or anything like that. So they just were like, well, you just focus on growing the baby. And I felt like, oh my God, how am I going to know if this little thing is okay and tracking along? And every day it was I found it such a struggle to just sit with it and just be like, you have to surrender to the uncertainty of it. And I saw my psychologist. Yes, psychologists have psychologists during this time. And that was such a massive help for me, because we just talked about the idea. I mean, I'm quite a type A person. I like organization and I love predictability. And this was neither of those. So the idea of just kind of leaning back into it and just being like, that, you know what, this is out of my hands. All I can do is try and look after myself the best I can and just hope for the best. And it's so hard because it's something that's so important to you. And yet you just, you know, anything could happen for any reason. And you just have to every day just surrender to the unknown. And I think for me, what was just helpful was honestly just one day at a time.
Yeah. Almost half a day at a time.
Half a day, exactly. And just trying, you know, to have little milestones in your head that you're working towards and just really hope for the best. But gosh, I mean, it's still hard.
You're in it still, right?
I'm still in it. And it's almost into my third trimester now. And there's this period of time, I don't know if you remember, but at least it was my experience. It's about like six, maybe it's 16 weeks to maybe like 20 weeks. For me, at least, that's probably where it was. And you lose your, well, I did, I'm sorry. You did. But you lose your first trimester symptoms. So all of the kind of nausea and fatigue. And you start to feel a little, like you're still tired, but you start to feel a little normal, but you can't feel the baby.
Yeah.
So it's scary. This time of, it was so scary. And I, you don't have a scan then until I think it's a 20-week anatomy scan. So I was just sitting there like, oh my goodness, is this baby okay? I have no idea. And that I found was a really hard period for me because you get some sort of mild reassurance from the symptoms.
Yeah. I'm still pregnant because I'm unwell, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But when they went away, it was really scary. Yeah. And then you have to wait. And then you get the anatomy scan at the end of it. And then that's full of
fear.
Unknown as well and fear.
So if you're already struggling with anxiety or other things that don't feel in your control, pregnancies are really, it's a mind loop. And that's when, again, you need more strategies in place to deal with it. And that's probably my encouragement is to find ways before and during. And even that simple question that I remember asking myself and asking people was, you know, what can I control today and what can't I control?
Yeah.
You know, I can't control that my body literally is heaving me to the bathroom, but I can control the way that my thoughts are coming through, or I can control the way that I'm going to speak to somebody to help get help. And that might be enough for the day. Those are the things I can control. And it might be that I'm going to ask for help from a doctor. That's my control. But I can't control when this is going to stop because it really is a physiological reaction happening in my body. And many people that go through illness and chronic illness will have a similar roller coaster in regards to how you have to surrender and how you have to really work on your mind to navigate through that. And I think pregnancy has, like you just said, it doesn't matter if you've had massive symptoms or if you've had little minor ones, it still messes with you in the fact of like, I don't know if I'm doing this right. Because even with all those books on the bookshelves and the up duffs and the different ones that are out there and, you know, how to be the best mother in the world books, it's like, I actually don't know. And I'm probably going to screw something up along the way.
Our pregnancies have become so much more isolated than they used to be. And even with your partner, the experience for them is so different. You know, thinking about, you know, the person carrying the baby sort of reaches parenthood a lot quicker than the other person. I mean, my partner is luckily fantastic, but it's a different experience for him. You know, all he can do is kind of watch, pick up the pieces. And it's hard for them too because, you know, the hormonal change is crazy. Like there's have been times where I am just crying and he is like, what are you crying? You know, what's going on? And I don't know. I'm just crying. And what do you do? So I think it's incredibly hard. And it's the person you love and care about going through. And like for you, you know, going through that awful illness and watching your partner, and I mean, we haven't even talked about body changes and what that's like. I mean, that could be a whole episode in itself. But they just have, you know, as best you can support, and you just kind of have to sit back, and you also have to surrender to your own uncertainty being the partner, because there's not much, definitely nothing you can do. You know, it's totally out of your head. You've provided what you needed to provide, and you just have to sit back. Yeah.
It's a good point, though. Like, if I look back and reflect on what would have been needed back then, I think, like, that emotional roller coaster you're talking about, still having that person that can still sit with you know that they can't fix it, because this is just around the way that you've been completely hijacked in that physiology, and that it's okay. That's probably a big part of it for that partner piece, has been like, you can still sit with them and know that's okay and that's very normal. And even when I went through my illness, and I think that was a really big lesson for us as a relationship, because that he didn't cope well with people being unwell. And I get that. It's not an easy thing for many partners to cope when somebody isn't well. And there often is the burden of like, well, I just have to focus on getting money in the door or doing this part of my work. And that can then end up leading to so much pressure on that whole dynamic when you've got that layer on top of it.
Yeah.
And I think in the end of the day, all I really probably wanted in the experience was somebody just being able to check in like that, like your partner was. It's like, are you okay? When the tears are coming and when you can't fight for your own sort of stuff as well. I think there's an element in that, even when you get to the labor part, which is, you know, not this episode.
No. I'm using avoidance there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that's probably something that we've learned along the way, is that there's different ways that you can approach helping someone. And one of them is problem solving. But sometimes what can you do? And so I think for him, after some training, he's learned that, you know, you just have to sit with, like you said, you just have to sit with it. I mean, there's nothing, what can you do? There are some really amazing women out there. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be people that you know, thank goodness for the internet in ways. Yeah. So much support systems out there for people struggling with fertility or first trimester anxiety. I remember I got a message from a friend of mine who she said how much she struggled with anxiety in the first trimester. And she's like, you know what? Any questions you have, I'm here. This is what I did that helped me to manage that. And it's just so powerful.
Yeah.
Just to, you know, if you've been through it and you know that someone else is in that first trimester, just reaching out and connecting with them, because that is what we're missing. We used to have a village.
Yep. The common humanity.
Yeah.
Common humanity, that we're not alone in that, and others have experienced that. And the high rate of maternal anxiety, like you said, for fertility, but it's really high still for actually going through that pregnancy.
Yeah.
And I think it's normal to feel that emotions, normal to feel uncertainty. So no wonder we go into this hypervigilance mode. We're also going to be breathing faster because of a progesterone that's been pouring through our body. So then our breathing pattern changes as well. It's one of the things that people don't kind of notice or take.
Yeah, and my heart rate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's the first sign I knew I was pregnant, because I went on a run and I was like,
that was your first sign?
Yeah, I went on a run, and this was before we tested, and I was like, gosh, my heart, why is my heart rate so high on this run that I do all the time? And I thought, shit, you know, because I Googled it, obviously. But it was good. It was all right. It was a good thing. I was pregnant. I was happy about it. But I've definitely noticed that my baseline heart rate is increased greatly. Yeah.
There are a few reasons for that as well. Obviously, we were pumping a lot of blood around to create the other human, but definitely progesterone. So one of your hormones, particularly in the early first trimester, is going through the roof.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why people that have breathing dysfunction before they get pregnant, they can have more the nausea and the anxiety as well, because they're already getting triggered with their breathing pattern changes. So a lot of the research I remember doing during that time was around, and I think there's still more information coming out around breathing dysfunction and then nausea response. So you can, again, know that you've been hijacked from internally physiology, but you can then work on shifting your breathing pattern to find it to be in a calmer state, which can then help to reset as much as you can, even though you're being overridden with the hormonal changes.
Wow. Well, that's something you don't hear about.
No. But again, that's the gift of being really unwell in pregnancies. Yes, share it on a podcast. And I remember talking about it in different talks, because it used to be my, like, here's my adversity story. And then I was like, oh, and then I got divorced. Oh, and then I got conned. I was like, but still, one of the lessons for me around pregnancy and sickness was around not listening into my nervous system and not listening into my body. And then often the biggest one, we'll talk about this the next time, is that postnatal depletion and really understanding what your body goes through and what you need to do to refuel, and not just postnatal depression, but actually that real depletion of energy and nervous system. So really listening into that body. One of the questions I had, though, was, like you said, it was around that body image and how people can deal with that change. Because it's a really big thing when, especially if you've already been focused and had some issues around feeling body acceptance, feeling good around how you are in your body. How do people navigate that during pregnancy?
Yeah, it's obviously it's such an individual experience. I mean, so part of the work that I do is I work at Trade in Eating Disorders and work a lot with eating disorders. And, you know, I feel like that experience of becoming pregnant can go in many different ways. And one of them actually is that it's quite a healing experience where you know, part of you starts to recenter your mind to the function of eating, you know, that it's not just for me, it's for this baby and I need to fuel myself and keep myself well. And so your mindset starts to change a little bit because so much of it is tied around like, well, how many calories does that have? You know, is this help me lose weight? But actually in pregnancy, we need to uplift weight. That's expected of us. So in ways it can be quite freeing for people. And that has been, you know, my experience working alongside people who struggle with bulimia or anorexia nervosa and trying to go through pregnancy. You know, in some cases, it's been quite healing for them. Of course, there's the other side of it that is a lot of comparison. You know, how do I look compared to other people? Am I too big? Am I not big enough?
Yes, that one's like it's both ways, isn't it?
Yeah,
like, it's no perfect version.
Exactly. Like, oh, I wish I had more of a bump, or gosh, I feel like I'm too heavy for this time. And then you get your nipples change, your boobs change, stretch marks. I mean, and what you can't do anything about it, and you have to fuel and you have to keep going, and it's not smooth sailing. For a lot of women, I don't think it's as easy as being like, wow, it's so beautiful, this baby that I'm growing, and it's so special. It's like, gosh, well, prior to this, so much of my self-worth was tied up on my appearance, and now I have to surrender to all of these changes, not knowing, you know, what happens at the end and what I come out looking like, and all of, you know, that there's not, it's not just this piece, it's the piece after as well. And so I think any advice that we've given in this podcast is every day at a time and trying to, you know, fuel in ways and move your body in ways that are compassionate and kind. And if you are worried about and get starting to re-engage and restrict or anything like that, it is so important to seek some help. You know, that doesn't have to be therapy necessarily, but it can be reaching out. And, you know, there's great dietitians out there as well who can support with helping you to fuel yourself adequately during pregnancy. But gosh, it is a really hard time.
And I think what keeps coming up as we keep talking, and as it always has with pregnancy, is it's not a one size fits all model. There's not a one story that you're going to have to fit into or a perfect box. And so you have to have navigate what the things are going to be that are going to help you feel better, learn to love your body so that you can show the modeling to the next generation as well. I think it's been a really big one for me, is sort of breaking cycles of negative talk around self-image from, you know, from other family, to then being able to do that so that my daughter doesn't get that programming.
Yeah.
So don't want that going forward. I want to be able to be like, well, I think she's beautiful and she thinks I'm beautiful. So why can't I be okay with that, even if I have the lumps? And, you know, she's older now, so it doesn't always come in. But when she was younger, you know, you'd be naked and showering and stuff. And she'd be like, that part, mum, and just, you know, poking in different ways. You're like,
that's because of you.
That's because of you. Yeah, that one, that's because of you. I remember doing some abs like once, and she was like, but you've been going to the gym. Like, no, Sebby, I have been. But, yeah, you'll find that there's a bit of destruction down there. I think often you see on the Instagram and the social media bouncing back, and it's like, oh, that's just so beautiful. And afterwards, and I'm like, that is not the reality. That is not normal.
No, and there are some amazing Instagrams and TikToks to follow for more realistic exploration of what postpartum and, you know, pregnancy bodies look like, but for most people. Mm. There are some people that, you know, do flip back, and that's
great.
What it is, but yeah, it's so about your own individual body and trying as best you can not to, and you will. I mean, it's natural. We all lean into social comparison, but just trying to remember that, you know, it's your story. Your body's going to look different to everyone else's, and there's pretty much sweet F all you can do about that. So some radical acceptance there. You know, I accept things for what they are. Doesn't mean I like them. Doesn't mean I agree with them, but I accept that that is my reality.
I look at those first few years of having kids, the hardest time of my life, but the best.
Mm.
So I'm excited for you.
Yeah, watch the space, everyone.
It's going to be good. And I'm looking forward to coming back and chatting all about that last part of the pregnancy and then navigating into that motherhood.
It'll be helpful for me, everyone, so I appreciate it.
I'll be asking questions people might have around that as we dive into it too, to see, you
know.
Oh,
sounds good.
What we would like people to know around that next chapter and stage. Beautiful. Cool. Thank you, Vic, for all your wisdom, and I look forward to chatting to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for tuning into the Bravery Academy. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button. And if you're looking to take your support for the podcast to the next level, visit patreon.com/thebraveryacademy to access exclusive content and get early access to our upcoming episodes. Your feedback means the world to us. So please take a moment to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you for being part of the Bravery Academy community. Stay brave, stay curious, and keep challenging yourself to grow. Until next time.
Hi there. I'm Heather Drago.
And I'm Sarah Saunders.
We host the podcast, That's a Hard No, about saying no and setting boundaries.
So you can become that true and empowered you that this world needs. Saying no isn't just okay.
It's the key to living an authentic, fulfilling life.
I'm a licensed professional clinical counselor. So while this podcast is in no way a replacement for one-on-one therapy, I suppose I know what I'm talking about.
I'd say so. We talk about learning to say no and set healthy boundaries and how it impacts mental health, physical health, relationships, parenthood, and more.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and visit our website, hardnopodcast.com.
We're here to help you find your no and say it unapologetically.
That's a hard no.